Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. All through the 19th century, it was established legal principle that owners of land also owned the airspace above the land. And from time to time, there were cases where people argued about invasion of the airspace over their land. And it seemed that also at this time, there was really no height limit. That is, theoretically, the idea was that your right went up forever. And maybe it would seem that there was no real good reason to have a height limit until the invention of the airplane. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be looking at a largely forgotten chapter in the history of property rights as we talk with Stuart Banner. He is professor of law at UCLA, and he is the author of the book Who Owns the Sky? The subtitle is The Struggle to Control Airspace from the Wright Brothers On. It is published by the Harvard University Press. And aside from looking very specifically at this particular issue, and that is arguments about aerial trespass, it is also in a larger sense about how it is that the law struggles to keep up with changing technology. Questions are certainly welcome as we move through the hour. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. You're listening around the states of Illinois, Indiana, all those places where the signal will travel over the air, or you happen to be listening on the internet. Either way, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Questions welcome. We just ask people to be brief so we can keep moving along, but anyone who is listening is welcome to call. Professor Banner, hello.
Hi, David.
Thanks for talking with us.
Well, yeah, thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. I think that you explained in the introduction to the book or in the preface that this was, in fact, something that you hadn't thought a great deal about, or perhaps your depth of knowledge on the subject of aerial trespass before you started to research the book was not particularly broad. What was it that led you even to start looking at this area of law?
Well, you know, there's a famous Supreme Court case about this called United States v. Cosby from the 1940s, and where the court held that frequent, very low overflights amounted to a trespass on the property rights of the landowner beneath. And it just seems so weird to me that the big case about this subject would come in the 1940s, so, you know, more than 40 years after the invention of the airplane. I thought, in all that time, you know, this must have come up. And so I thought I would just poke around and see what there was. And I kind of stumbled upon this issue. This was a major legal question from roughly 1900 right through the 40s.
And that's, and as you explain, you found suddenly that there was this great body of law, of writing, this long debate that happened virtually. It started with hot air balloons and zeppelins, things like that. It started there, and it continued all the way up to the case that you mentioned, which was the Supreme Court case, which was 1946. So that's
right.
That's a long time between 1946 and the Wright brothers for people to be arguing about exactly what this all means.
No, that's right. And you know, this was a big worry among a lot of people, lawyers especially, but really anybody, a big worry that the promise of aviation couldn't be realized because, you know, where could the plane fly without trespassing, right? As you said, the old common law rule was that a landowner owned up to the heavens, you know, all the way down in principle. If you owned a patch of land, you owned down to the center of the earth and all the way up to the heavens. And you know, if that was true, you know, airplanes they wouldn't be able to fly anywhere.
Well, you point to the this idea that you own the land, you own everything above and everything below. And I'm sure, though, that there had been some discussion and debate of the question of how far down a person's property rights go. I mean, yet theoretically, they may go down to the center of the earth, but practically, there are both practical limitations, and you would have to say that the law would have to get involved and say at some point, we do have to have some sort of bottom limit as to how far down your property rights go.
Yeah, although not really. I mean, so for example, you know, if you own land, you own the right to, say, mine minerals or oil or whatever happens to be below your land, you know, And there was really never any occasion to have any lower limit. And I, you know, as far as I mean, I'm certainly no expert in mining law, but to my knowledge, it's still the case that, that you can mine down as far as you want to.
Was this an issue, or in what way was this an issue, that is aerial trespass, before flying became common?
Oh, yeah. Well, this was actually an issue going back hundreds of years. I mean, there's cases back in the 1600s, 1600s, about neighbors who built parts of their houses that overhung their neighbors' land, you know, like roofs and you know, tilted buildings and things like that. And there was no doubt that those were trespasses. That the courts in England and the United States consistently held that overhanging building parts, overhanging tree branches, those were trespasses, even if they never touched the land beneath. And then this was a principle that was applied in the 19th century to things like elevated railroad tracks, telegraph wires, telephone wires, even bullets crossing, you know, shot from one person's land across another person's land, never landing, never hitting the ground. Those were held to be trespasses. I mean, there was no doubt that the landowner owned the airspace above the land. Now, of course, you know, before the airplane, there really wasn't any occasion really to test the upper limit of that principle, because nothing really got as high.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand that if you were going to put up a permanent structure like elevated train tracks, or you're going to string wires for telegraph or something like that, you're going to put up a permanent structure, then you could think in terms of having some kind of exchange for the right to do that. In a sense, you'd be renting the space that
right.
person owns. In the case of an overflight, the person's presence in your space is going to be momentary, or at least it's going
right.
to be brief.
Right.
Why did people even think that was a problem if someone was going to fly over and what might be for a matter of minutes in your property? And if it really didn't touch you in any way, I think one would have to make some kind of argument that maybe that you were harmed, or that you were experiencing some kind of loss as a result of that brief trespass.
Well, there's a legal answer to that, and there's a factual answer. The legal answer is that it had always been true, and I mean, indeed, it's still true, that trespass on the ground doesn't require any degree of permanence. So if I just walk across your land, you know, I'm only there on your land for a few seconds, that's a trespass. You know, that I've committed a wrong. Now, your damages might be very small, or might be zero. In which case, if you were to sue me, right, the compensation I might owe you would be very small or even zero. But there was no doubt that was a trespass. So the briefness, you know, temporariness was, or you know, even lack of harm was no barrier to a suit for trespass. So that's the legal answer. The factual answer is that, you know, in the early years of flight, airplanes, they flew very low. They were loud. Mm. They had propellers that, you know, threw up a lot of dust and so on. They frightened animals. They frightened people on the ground. Plus, you know, they had open cockpits, and so you never knew when a wrench was going to drop from the sky, or the pilot's lunch might fall out. You know, they crashed a lot too. The early planes, and so, you know, you didn't want to be underneath when they crashed, and so aviation actually posed more of a menace to landowners in its early years than it does now. I mean, now obviously planes fly overhead all the time, and we don't even notice them. But you would have noticed a plane if it flew overhead in, say, in 1910.
Yeah, so it would be easy to make the argument that constituted a nuisance at the very least, and that there actually was a potential for harm at the worst.
Right, and even if there was no harm, I mean, the big worry wasn't so much that landowners were going to sue aviators and get damages, right? Because the damages would be, you know, probably in most cases pretty small. The worry was that they would get injunctions, that is, court orders, barring aviators from flying over private property. And if they were to do that, then the airplanes would be confined to flying over to avoiding private property. They have to, you know, for instance, try to stay over streets or, you know, stay over public parks and things like that. And everyone knew that wasn't going to be feasible. Hmm.
So there really was a concern here in the early days of aviation that if this became a problem and people began to perhaps enforce their rights, that could be a real stumbling block, a real problem when it came to developing aviation.
Right. No, that's right. And some people say, well, why not just pass a law saying that the airspace is free to aviators? Why not take this right away from property owners? The worry there was if you did that, that would violate the constitutional rights, the property rights of the landowners. The takings clause of the Constitution requires compensation when people to property owners when they're deprived of property rights. The worry was, well, if we're going to open up the airspace, that's going to require a massive program of government compensation to every single landowner in the country.
Hmm. Well, and I suppose though they could have said, well, what we're going to do is we're going to set up corridors that the planes will fly in,
right?
And in as we would do if we were going to build a highway,
right.
We might indeed have to pay somebody some money to buy the property from them so that we could put the road down. And where there people are saying, well, maybe what we're going to have to do is, in a sense, construct aerial highways, and we're going to have to pay the landowners underneath
right.
for the right to overfly their territory. And that's just something that we're going to decide that the country needs to develop aviation. Planes have to be able to fly, and this is the way that we're going to do it. And if it's going to cost us some money, well, it's no different than it would be if we decided to build a highway.
Right, exactly, right. And so that was something that was seriously proposed in the early years of flight.
Well, we have a caller here, and our guest, let me introduce again, is Stuart Banner. He is professor of law at the University of California at Los Angeles, and we are talking about his book, Who Owns the Sky? The Struggle to Control Airspace from the Wright Brothers on. It's published by the Harvard University Press and explores this idea of aerial trespass, about who has the right to the airspace over the land, and how people thought about that and discussed that and argued about it as aviation was developing in the country. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here, have a couple callers. We'll start with someone on our toll-free line. This is line number 4. Hello? Hello, is there a call there on line 4?
Hello? Oh, yeah. Hey there.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if this issue has almost been turned on its head over time. I have a buddy who lives near a small little airport, and, you know, he's always tired of the planes flying over his property. And we joke about, hey, what if we just built something really tall that would stop those planes from flying there? But it seems to me that airports nowadays basically kind of have a right of way over individuals' airspace, where there's no way a city or county government would ever let you block the flight of those airplanes. And I will take my answer off air.
All right.
Yeah, well, that's right. In fact, in the early years of flight, sometimes people next to airports did build very high fences for exactly that purpose. And the worry was that among aviators was that if this spread, this was going to get really dangerous. You know that you never knew when you were trying to land or take off. There's suddenly this big obstacle. But you're right that these days I think if you tried to do that and block planes from taking off and landing, they probably wouldn't let you do that.
Well, I suppose this is, in a sense, jumping ahead in the story, but we talked earlier about the fact that when you started in on this, you were aware of a particular case dealing with this issue that was heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. And this was 1946. And so for all of these years, people were arguing between the time of the Wright brothers and even before when people were using hot air balloons. People were talking about it then. So that it took a long time for this to get resolved. Why was it that it took all those years for there to be some kind of resolution on
it was because of the constitutional issue. I mean, the in a lot of countries, a lot of European countries that didn't have strong constitutional protections for property rights, just by statute, they just passed a law saying, okay, planes can fly above certain heights, and it's not a trespass. That never, people proposed doing that in the United States, but that was the lurking worry was that courts would hold such statutes unconstitutional. And so what had to happen was that the common law itself had to change. That is, the common law, the law made by judges in the course of deciding cases, had to change. The rule of the rule that a landowner owned up to the heavens, that was a doctrine of the common law that had been, you know, said in countless cases by English judges, American judges over the years. But the common law changes. It changes very gradually on a case-by-case basis. And so beginning in the 20s and 30s, you started to see courts very gradually, case by case, changing the common law, saying, well, no, what the rule really means is that a landowner owns only up so high. Now, there was a lot of disagreement on exactly how high, but the common law gradually started changing, until really by the 30s, by the 40s, the general view was that landowners no longer owned up to the heavens, and so it wouldn't be unconstitutional to allow planes to fly above a certain level. Now, this Cosby case from the 1940s, the one you mentioned, that involved planes flying very low, just a few feet over these people's houses. And so the court said that would be a taking, that would be a deprivation of property rights. But the planes above, you know, an ambiguously defined height would not be a taking. That was the kind of the final word on the subject from the Supreme Court. But the law in lower courts had been developing to that point all along.
Well, in that particular case, did the Supreme Court actually say the property right of the landowner extends up to X? You know, did they say 50 feet, 70 feet, 100 feet?
No, there's no number. You know, none of these cases actually put a number on it, because obviously so much of it is going to depend on circumstances. So that if you own vacant land, you know, you might think, well, one height would be appropriate. Whereas if you own a skyscraper, right, you know, you know that same height limit might cause, you know, have a plane crashing into the middle of a skyscraper, right? You might. So you know what I'm saying? I mean, it depends on the circumstance. And so all the cases, including Cosby, that talked about height limits, expressed them in very ambiguous terms. So they would say, speak very generally of concepts like the upper airspace and the lower airspace, or so much of the airspace as a landowner needs to enjoy the land, and so on.
We have someone else to talk with here on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
How are we doing?
Good.
Got a good question, I think, about the old wind turbines that are coming into the area. What if I want the plane to fly on my land and my neighbor puts the wind turbine too close? In other words, for crop dusting purposes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the specific answer to your question, but what your question brings up is the fact that these controversies still exist today. I mean, think of all the users of airspace, you know, from airplanes to wind turbines to, you know, model rockets to, I mean, you name it, people, you know, helicopters for, you know, traffic helicopters and so on. I mean, people use the airspace for all sorts of things. And so there's developed over the years an elaborate regulation slicing up the airspace both horizontally and vertically, and you know, and allocating different uses to different different users. My book is really about the very first chapter of that story. Well, two of the first chapters of that story, right? One is the one we've been discussing, which is the division of rights in the airspace between owners of land beneath and aviators above. So that's one of the early issues. The other big early issue, which we haven't really talked about yet, is the question of national sovereignty in the airspace. This was a big issue from roughly 1900 to 1914, and that is, did the sovereign power of a nation extend above the ground to the airspace? Or to put it more concretely, did a nation have the power to exclude aviators from other countries? Or, on the other hand, was the atmosphere like the ocean, a zone that was free to all, that anyone, regardless of nationality, could travel in? That was another big issue, really in the first decade and a half or so of flight.
I've heard of a situation, I guess, where a landowner, elderly lady, you know, doesn't want to sell off or sell her rights for wind turbines, and basically the three property owners around there too.
Yeah.
So now we have the need for crop dusting more often, you know, anymore with the insect problems and everything. So therefore, the tenant on that property may not be able to use airplanes to spray the crop time. And he's already worried, well, how is he going to collect damages because the wind turbines are in his way?
Yeah. I mean, these sorts of conflicts over the air, you know, they still pop up all the time.
Very interesting.
All right.
Thank you
for the call. Well, that I do want to indeed come back to the question of national sovereignty, but to talk about this kind of thing for a moment, I think also there was early on when people were talking about this issue of, well, how do we regulate airspace? There was some debate or conversation about whether there should be a national standard. This should be national law,
right,
or perhaps whether each state should do the regulating on, and I suppose even on a local level, people could have thought, well, we should be able to make these regulations. And I'm sure then people said, well, it's just going to be too confusing if every few miles there's going to be a different rule about how high you can fly or whether you can fly. How did people think about that, this as an issue of state or local rights to regulate versus the need for perhaps some kind of national standard?
Well, yeah, that was another big aspect of the question, because in the early decades of the 20th century, the power of Congress over these sorts of issues was really uncertain. I mean, the power of Congress rested on the Commerce Clause of the Constitution, which these days is interpreted to give Congress power, you know, virtually over any aspect of commercial life. Back then, though, it was interpreted much more restrictively, and so it was a very serious question in the early years whether Congress had any power to regulate flights that did not cross state lines, which, you know, in the early years of flight, most flights didn't cross state lines. And so whether trespass rules and other sorts of issues, you know, things like licensing and air traffic control and things like that, were within the competence, within the power of the federal government, that was a seriously debated question in the early years. That's why, you know, the most countries passed national airplane regulations regarding things, not just trespass, but things like licensing pilots, certifying the airworthiness of planes, and so on. Most nations pass statutes like that very quickly. In the United States, it wasn't until 1926, so you know, a quarter century after the invention of the airplane, it took before Congress passed the Air Commerce Act of 1926. And the reason for the delay was just this: there was considerable uncertainty as to whether Congress even had the power to regulate flights that didn't cross state lines.
Let's talk with another caller. We have someone in Champaign. This is line number one.
Yes, this came up in my case a couple years ago when we wanted to do a reconnaissance for scoping out low-lying land along creeks in Illinois for installing artificial wetlands. We could go along the roads and look at the land from the road, but we really needed to go into the land, and so we got a helicopter, because we didn't want to have to get permission from each landowner to go walking over on their land. And when I asked the helicopter pilot about this, about the legality of it, he told me that we could actually land on it. I asked him, how low can we go and still be legal? And he said we could land on it, and as long as we didn't get out of the helicopter, we were okay. And I just wonder if that comports with your understanding of the law.
Not really, and that sounds weird to me, right? If stepping on land,
yeah, I know, it did to me,
right? Why wouldn't a helicopter on? I mean, it seems like a helicopter would be worse than stepping on land.
Yeah, that's right. Well, with the downdraft and everything, you're going to do far more damage to the land than you would just by walking on it.
Yeah, I agree.
So, is there a number? I mean, I guess you're from what you said previously, there is no number. It just has to be high enough that you're not doing any real damage.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on the circumstances.
Yeah. Well, we needed to get very low so that we could kind of see this is land that just has a very gradual grade to it. And we wanted to get very low so that we could see the slope of it. You can't see that slope from any height. That's why we had to use a helicopter instead of a plane.
Yeah.
And I guess that it sounds like from what you're saying, anything that we would have done that would have worked for us, we actually didn't get very low, as it turned out. But
yeah.
Anything that would have worked for us probably would have been trespassing, right?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, okay. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions again? Welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Stuart Banner. He's professor of law at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles, and is the author of a book that looks at the debate over property rights in the air. The title of his book is Who Owns the Sky? The Struggle to Control Airspace from the Wright Brothers On. It's published by the Harvard University Press and looks at the fact that for a long, long time, common law held that property owners, they owned everything that was under their land and they owned everything that was above their land. And that became an issue as airplanes became more and more common and people were interested in developing commercial aviation in the United States. So there the question was, well, if you fly over somebody's land, is that trespassing? Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You did mention a little earlier that also, in a sense, part of this, one, there are a set of questions here about individual landowners and what their rights are. There were also a set of questions here for nations as they confronted the question of whether or not they had a right to control their national airspace. And in fact, whether or not they had the right to ban people from flying over their countries. And it became it became more and more an issue. Aerial warfare became more and more an issue. And I think World War I really sharpened this debate. It became something that countries felt that more and more they had to confront.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, World War I put an end to this debate, right? But before World War I, it was a very serious debate about this. That is, the ocean, you know, except for the parts closest to the shore, the ocean was a zone free of national sovereignty. Anyone in the world could go there, and so a lot of people seriously argued that the air ought to be the same. That just as the ocean was so big and incapable of being possessed. The same was true of the atmosphere. Plus, there were some more some pragmatic worries. People argued, well, what if if nations have the power to exclude foreign aircraft? What about landlocked countries? Right? How are they ever going to be able to get planes in and out? And the ocean going commerce had so enriched the world that the airplane promised to do the same. It'd be another great step forward, and people were very worried that if you allowed nations to exclude foreign aircraft, to shut their borders, the borders of their airspace, that the world would be denied this great benefit. But then, of course, once World War I starts, no one makes that argument anymore. Everyone realizes, hey, we have to be able to shut our borders to foreign aircraft, and in fact, that's what nations did during World War I. And so after World War I, the part of the peace treaty putting an end to World War I, part of that was an agreement regarding international aviation, where that proceeded from this premise that nations were sovereign over their airspace and that they had every right to decide who was going to fly in. They had every right to shut their borders. And then, the treaty then said, nations would waive that right in exchange for similar waivers from other countries with certain sharply defined circumstances and so on. And that's still the regime of international air travel that we have today.
We have other callers. Next, someone who is listening in Chicago, calling from there on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Thank you.
Yes.
I'm concerned not only about the air, who owns the sky, air rights above, but the quality of the air. We find that we have drifts of clouds of dust emanating from other continents over the oceans towards our proper land, and vice versa, and the greenhouse gases and emissions that are involved now, so that the very air rights are being trampled upon willy-nilly. And who's to account for the any penalties and so forth. I don't know if any considerations are in your thoughts on that matter.
Well, I mean, it's true. Air pollution, over time has increasingly become an international issue. I mean, I don't know if I have anything particularly insightful to say about that. My book is not so much about the quality of the air as it is about rights to use the airspace,
yes,
in which the air circulates.
Yeah, but then it involves the damage to your air rights to the degree. We also have the matter of people who have these manure farms and all the foul odors that emanate from that upon neighboring airspace and so forth.
Right.
So, it's another issue, you know.
I think we'd have. I expect we could probably find someone whose special area was environmental law, and we could probably talk all day about those kinds of things.
Yeah. Although I will say, I mean, there one connection there is that in the early years of this sovereignty debate, the question of whether nations had sovereign power over the airspace above their land, one of the arguments that was frequently made in favor of national power was that nations were already, even in the early 1900s, they were already regulating air pollution. I mean, that was already a problem with industrialization and so on. And since they were already regulating air pollution, right, people argued, well, now, wait a second, if nations are not sovereign over their airspace, by what right are they regulating air quality?
Yeah. DeWitt County, another caller here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I had another situation that modern times have brought on. A person in this area a few years ago liked to fly one of these parachute things that's powered by a lawnmower, and but it putts around, and one day we noticed he was harassing wildlife, chasing deer, chasing, circling around flocks of crows, and circling our house at, window level. And I considered, trying a deer slug through the engine or something, but thought better of it, and wound up having to call DNR because it is it's against the law to harass wildlife, and they gave him a talking to, and he's stayed away since then. But don't know what is there if he hadn't been harassing wildlife. How do you keep somebody from circling your house at low speed looking in the window?
Well, that sounds like he's almost certainly low enough to be trespassing, even if he doesn't get on the land. This has been an issue that has, it's been a live question ever since the invention of the hot air balloon in the late 1700s, because people had similar complaints about hot air balloonists. They were flying low over people's land, they were bothering animals, things like that. I mean, this has been a source of controversy now for more than 200 years.
It was quite an irritation. Got a hold of the county sheriff, said talk to the FCC, and they didn't answer. And
yeah,
only got the DNR after him. So
all right,
I guess the problem's resolved.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll go on here to line number two. This is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. First, I want to throw in at some of the foul air quality issues created by individuals could possibly be dealt with under the common law of nuisance, even though trespass might be problematic.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
But I come from a region of the country where, when I grew up, the production of oil was a very significant activity, and many landowners had oil wells on their parcels of land. And I'm going to go down, not go to the heavens. I'm going to say we own everything at one time down to the center of the earth. And a major issue we had in that part of the country was the issue of slant drilling.
Right.
And the question was always asked whether, to what extent one could engage in slant drilling and not violate the law of trespass. Can you comment on that and how that may have evolved?
Well, I mean, I can tell you the old common law rule was, you were circumscribed by your property line, but then you could go straight down as far as you wanted, but that if you slanted over underneath someone else's land, well, that was their land. That was you were trespassing. If the property lines were not lines, but rather they were like walls, that went all the way down to the center of the earth, and all the way up to the heavens. Now that was the old common law. I mean, I'm certainly no expert on the law of oil and gas, which is very specialized and complicated.
Right.
But my impression is that whatever the common law was, you know, now it's just there's been largely superseded by all sorts of regulations.
Okay, thanks. So maybe right. State statutes vary from state to state, and they have in essence modified or preempted
yeah.
common law.
That's my impression. But again, you know, I certainly couldn't claim to.
Yeah, all I can say it was a source of great controversy.
No, I'm sure.
Especially when black gold was really black gold.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank
yep.
you. I'm thinking about the previous caller and his example of his house being buzzed by the guy with the ultralight. I'm not quite sure what sort of regulations there are for those kinds of crafts. I think that if there are regulations, they're much more loose than other kinds of planes. I'm just thinking about the early days, what would have happened and what sort of recourse landowners had. It would not surprise me if there would have been a day when someone would have felt perfectly justified stepping out their front door and with their shotgun and shooting at someone who was flying over their land. What did people do?
Yeah, well, I think most of the time, especially in the early years, they just sort of stood in awe at the novelty of it all and didn't really complain. But when people were aggrieved by low flying airplanes or other sorts of aircraft, you know, they were practical limits to what they could do. I mean, every once in a while, you know, ordinary people would threaten to shoot, but everyone knew that if you actually shot someone down, I mean, you were committing a crime. Even if they were trespassing, you can't shoot trespassers on your physical land. You know, trespassers on the ground, you can't. You're not allowed to go shoot at them. You know, same with trespassers in the air. So that wasn't practical. Everyone realized that suits for damages weren't going to be very practical because, you know, it costs something to sue in terms of time and money. It's just probably not worth it in terms of because of the very small damages that you would get. The more serious worry, the more serious remedy from the perspective of the landowner would be a suit for an injunction, that is a court order barring people from flying over your land. The problem there from the landowner's perspective was that a court order has to apply to a particular defendant, so that if person A flies over your land, well, you can get a court order barring them from flying over your land, but that's not going to apply to person B and person C and so on. And so the worry was it wasn't going to be cost effective even to get injunctions. The one exception to that, I guess, though, is that landowners who live near airports could sometimes sue the airport itself and get an injunction against everybody at the airport from flying. But other than that, I mean, everyone sort of realized that the trespass remedies for most landowners existed in principle. In practice, though, in almost all cases, landowners were very unlikely to actually use them. And so many people argued, hey, we don't really have a problem at all, because even though airplanes are technically going to be trespassing, you know, no one's going to sue them, and so we don't have to worry. But, of course, that's not a very satisfying answer either.
Yeah. Another caller, Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Actually, someone mentioned what I was going to talk about. On the pollution end, wasn't there a case recently about Ohio River Valley power plants causing acid rain in Pennsylvania and New York, and went to the Supreme Court and the EPA, everybody was suing everybody. And that's an air quality issue. But also I was going to ask you something about there are, you know, hints, about every couple of years, there's hints that microwaves cause brain tumors in certain people because of cell phone usage. And I know that microwaves, until they're focused on the antenna, are scattered. If they were to find something to that effect, since we have so much electronic media moving through the air now, you know, Wi-Fi, this kind of stuff, if there was some danger involved, would it be that your personal airspace there, you know, somebody's passing through your head or whatever, your body, is this would this be tied in this sort of issue? Would you know?
Yeah, you know, These days, probably not. But in the early years, of radio, this was actually the question of trespass was a serious question with the development of the radio industry as well. There was some worry. Now, wait a second. If we're sending electromagnetic waves across people's property, is that a trespass? You know, is the same property doctrine that might potentially bottle up the aviation industry? Is it also going to bottle up the radio industry? And of course, you know, as it turned out, it ended up being less of a serious barrier to radio. I mean, it was people argued about it for a few years, and then kind of everyone there quickly developed a consensus that no, radio waves, in fact, are not trespassing because they're not sufficiently physical. That was a solution that you couldn't apply to airplanes.
Oh, I see. Well, we're interesting because now I know how law is not really. There's never a real resolution to these issues because there's always another case.
Yeah.
I was going to say you're talking about airspace, and I noticed if you, my brother-in-law was a bomber pilot, and he always had these air charts, navigation charts. Where he'd bring to them, the huge pictures of the United States and all these countries, and they have all these restricted airspace, which is ostensibly, military,
right?
Nuclear reactors, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But it's interesting that. I'm really interested in your book. Did you write a book about this, I'm guessing, because I came in late?
Yeah.
But it's just interesting how all of a sudden something becomes an issue. And I'm just wondering what will become the next issue. And thanks a lot. I appreciate your work.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks.
Well, that really is I'm glad we've gotten around to this point. Here, I'll tell you what, real quick, for the benefit of anybody who might tune in, I want to introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with Stuart Banner. He's professor of law at University of California, Los Angeles, and has indeed written a book on the subject that we're discussing. The title of his book is Who Owns the Sky? The Struggle to Control Airspace from the Wright Brothers On. It is published by the Harvard University Press and looks specifically at this issue of rights in the air, aerial trespass, and just how far landowners' rights extend up in the air. But as I've mentioned, at least at the beginning of the program, part of your interest here is in the way that law tries to cope with changing technology.
Right.
And I'm sure we could probably come up with some number of examples. And as things continue to change in the future, It's always going to be a challenge for the law to catch up because something will happen, something will change, there'll be a new technology, and suddenly people will be asking questions that they never asked before. Perhaps they didn't have to ask because that thing didn't exist.
Right. I mean, so we're seeing it now, for example. I mean, one of the big issues, say, over the last decade is involves intellectual property rights to things like music and films on the Internet. Right, that's been a big issue. Another big issue involves property rights in genetic material. It's a constant process where some sort of new invention, new technology brings up legal questions that, in one sense, are new. Right, but in another sense, they're easily analogized to older questions that have already been resolved, and so. When the airplanes first came up, people started now. We will analogize airplanes to overhanging tree branches or bullets fired across people's property. You first have rockets and satellites in the 50s, the question was, well, are they infringing the sovereign airspace? As Sputnik beeps overhead, circles the globe. Is it infringing the sovereignty of the nations below? Of course, people's lawyers' first move is to analogize satellites to older technologies like airplanes. Now with the Internet, questions of who owns, say, for example, the rights to music distributed over the Internet, first analogy is to older forms of distribution like, CDs and records and so on. So, new technologies throw up new legal issues, but legal issues, they're never completely new. They always have some similarity to older issues, and the debate is always, well, are those similarities, should they be controlling or should the differences be controlling?
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes left. We have another caller here. This is someone on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hello. There is a legal question about radio waves. In Italy, there's been a couple of suits the government has brought against some shortwave broadcasters whose radiation field has exceeded their European standards in electrical magnetic radiation. per square meter and that kind of thing. So there are some radio wave suits out there. We don't have the stringent regulations here in the United States, but there are stronger ones in Europe.
Right. No, that's interesting. I mean, one issue, obviously that comes up a lot in any sort of broadcasting, or any sort of or even cell phones, things like that, is property rights in the electromagnetic spectrum. That is, rights to use particular frequencies, particular segments of the electromagnetic spectrum. That's been a very live issue these days. You know, to what extent should we recognize property rights? You know, that can be bought and sold in rights to use the electromagnetic spectrum. It's an issue that began with the invention of radio, you know, and the first radio regulations in the 1920s, and we still see it today with, you know, where the government auctions off chunks of the spectrum, rights to use particular chunks of the spectrum to, you know, cell phone companies and Wi-Fi and things like that.
But these were specifically regarding health and
stuff. Right.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Just as a way of finishing up, I want to stay with this idea of the law and the way that it tries to change, to try to keep up with changes in society and changes in technology. And I guess I'm interested in the idea we discussed earlier that for a long time common law held that the landowner owned everything above and everything below, and that theoretically the right below went all the way down to the center of the earth, straight down along your property line. Everything that was under there was yours. And that at one point then the idea was, in a similar way, straight up, everything was
right.
Yours. And that you talked about how over time, gradually, the common law changed, and the change, I suppose the thing is that we decided there was some common good we would regulate airspace, but it would have to be something that people could use for the purposes of developing aviation, for shipping goods and people, and perhaps just people's right to fly. And that was something that over time, so we got to beyond this point where we said that people's rights extended as far up as you could go.
Mm-hmm.
That gets me to this idea that, well, what, you know, common law, perhaps we have some ideas that there are just some things that are settled and established and they've always been that way and they're not going to change. Well, that's not the case.
No, that's right. I mean, the law is not, you know, it's not written in stone. It's not imposed on us from on high. You know, I mean, it's made by human beings, and it's always changing. Now, some aspects of it change more quickly or more often than other aspects. I mean, there are parts of our property law that haven't changed in 500 years. You know, whereas there are other parts that are completely new. But even the parts that have been around for 500 years, who knows, right? I mean, there could some new development could take place tomorrow that would make us want to rethink that as well. So yeah, it's really everything's open to change all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose it also takes people noticing that things are changing, or people, and I guess in part, I'm sort of thinking of characters like Charles Moore that you mm-hmm. started out talking about at the beginning of the book. There has to be somewhere the first person who says, hey, wait a minute.
Right.
There's something here that's different, and how are we going to deal with that? You know, someone raises the question, is the first one to raise the question that nobody has thought about.
Right.
Before.
So it takes someone to notice it, but then it also for there to actually be change, it takes lots of people caring a lot about it, you know, and so the possibility of air travel. I mean, this was something that a lot of people were very interested in the early 20th century, understandably. And you know, for the first time, it used to be right before the airplane, airspace was much more valuable to the landowners beneath than to the public at large, because there just really wasn't much to be gained from trespassing in other people's airspace. Well, the airplane changed that completely. Right now the airspace was collectively worth much more to non-landowners than it was to landowners, right? The whatever minimal damage a landowner suffered from airplanes overhead was vastly outweighed by the gains to the public from air travel. And so eventually the law changed, you know, but I guess the point of the book is that it took a very long time to change, and the change was not at all direct. It kind of twisted and turned this way and that until finally we got to where we are.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps that says something about our strong commitment to the idea of property rights, which is still leads us into all sorts of very difficult and contentious kind of situations where we're trying to figure out the how we work out the competing rights, personal property rights, and this notion that is much more difficult to define of public good.
Right. I mean, that you stated at the most abstract level that way, the conflict between individual property rights and then the community at large. I mean, that's one of those eternal questions that pops up in different guises, you know, at different points. And so you could think of the whole dispute about airspace as just one episode in that larger story.
Yeah. Well, it is though. Do we have a stronger commitment, or is that's sort of where our gut is? Our stronger commitment to the idea of personal property rights, as opposed to the idea that there is some sort of public good that may trump that?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think we have a strong commitment to both, and there's an inherent tension there, and how we resolve that tension varies widely from issue to issue and from period to period.
Mm. Well, I think at that we're going to have to finish up. For people who are interested in reading some more on this subject, let me again tell you about the book. The title is Who Owns the Sky? The Struggle to Control Airspace, from the Wright Brothers on, by our guest Stuart Banner. He is professor of law at University of California, Los Angeles, and looks at what happened in the early years of aviation as people started to think about the idea of, indeed, who owns the sky, who has the right to that property, and what does that mean for aviation? What does that mean for individual landowners? What does that mean for nations? Some interesting stuff there. Professor Banner, thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.